Finding a Way to Mental Wellness from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Today is Thursday, May 20th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk about Mental Health Awareness Month for the month of May. Serene Thinalka is with us. She's a mental health counselor and works for Urban Indian Health. We'll talk about Indigenous and traditional paths toward mental wellness. We talk with an SDSU professor who was in India during the second wave of the coronavirus and how the inspiration for a new protocol to prevent the virus was born. We've got Eric Helland with us today for South Dakota Home and Garden. We'll talk about vegetables and herbs co-mingling in your garden space. And Craig Maddock is with us later in the hour. Major League Baseball and a return back home. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Anti-abortion activists say 2021 has been a breakthrough year for legislation in several states seeking to prohibit abortions based on a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome. Two such bills have been signed into law in South Dakota and Arizona. Two more are pending in North Carolina and Texas. Most significantly, a federal appellate court says Ohio could begin to implement a 2017 law that previously had been put on hold. Similar laws remain blocked by the courts in several other states. The conflicting rulings increase the chances that the U.S. Supreme Court will consider one of the cases. South Dakota business leaders and immigration advocates want government immigration programs to improve. A virtual roundtable offered conversation and information about the complex topic. One federal program that gets attention is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals called DACA. Karen Benitez-Lopez is a DACA recipient. She joined in on the discussion and explained some of the immigration procedure.
I've come to find out that not everybody knows the process you have to go to, how any little thing you could do could jeopardize renewing your permit. So we're actually here contributing to the community. We're not just going out and committing crimes or trying to live off the government, because I know that's been a big deal too.
Benitez Lopez says DACA recipients face challenges. They have trouble getting loans or preventing deportation. Americans for Prosperity is a libertarian conservative political advocacy group. Executive Director Don Hager is calling on the federal government to resolve the problem.
That's what's broken, is the system. It's the immigrants and dreamers are not the problem, it's the government system.
The South Dakota Chamber of Commerce sponsored the event. President and CEO David Owen led the discussion. For weather today, we're seeing sunny skies in the west with scattered showers and thunderstorms there later this afternoon, and some of the storms could be severe. In the northeast, mostly sunny skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. In the southeast, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Today's highs are expected in the upper 70s to the upper 80s statewide. That will cool down later tonight with lows in the lower 50s west to the lower 60s in the east. Partly to mostly cloudy skies statewide this evening. Expect the east to be a bit breezy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight. And in the west, some scattered showers with some severe storms closer to midnight. On Friday, increasing clouds west with a chance of showers and possible thunderstorms in the afternoon. Mostly cloudy skies southeast, but gradually becoming sunny, while the northeast just mostly sunny. Tomorrow's highs are expected in the upper 60s northwest to the upper 80s, lows in the lower 40s northwest to the upper 60s in the east. Expect a chance of showers in the northeast with possible thunderstorms tomorrow evening, and showers and storms are likely in the west over the night. There are additional chances for showers and thunderstorms beginning Saturday night through Monday. Some of the storms expected may become strong to severe. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota tumbles back to the bottom in teacher pay 5 years after the Blue Ribbon Task Force determined to solve the pay gap problem for state educators. Morgan Mattson reports for Argus Leader Media in Sioux Falls and has been following the story. She joins us now for an update. Morgan, thanks for being on In the Moment. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
For listeners who don't remember the work of the Blue Ribbon Task Force, tell us a little bit about when this started. It's a Governor Dugard program, correct?
Yes, it is. So in 2016, this is when I was a senior in high school, by the way, just aging me a little bit. So former Governor Dennis Dugard had put together this task force with lawmakers to, you know, update the school funding formula to hopefully, you know, increase what was the last in the nation teacher pay then.
Yeah.
It was about at $42,000. So what they came up with was this half-cent increase in the state sales tax, which amounted to about $67 million then. And their target was to make the average teacher pay, you know, $48,500 in the first year. So that was the goal for to do that by 2017. And then they actually didn't meet that target yet until just this last year, when the actual average teacher salary was a little over $48,900.
Yeah. So how did we get to the point where now we're back at the bottom of the nationwide list? Can you help people understand what's happened recently that would cause that? And then we'll move into how the Noem administration is addressing the problem right now. But first, how did we get to the bottom again?
Right. Well, while we did, you know, increase the salary over the years, the rankings did not improve because, you know, other states were also trying to improve their teacher pay at the same time we were. So just this last year, we went from 48th in the nation to 50th again. And, you know, what happened really was that the 2016 task force, they created this law that requires the state to provide an annual funding increase to schools at a factor of 3% or inflation, whichever was less. The state did fully fund that statute in the first year, but not in the second or third years because of what we had reported in the past was a, quote, struggle with cash flow, end
sure.
quote. So by 2019, the state was short a little over $3 million of its agreement, and educators at the time were kind of asking for money to backfill the rest, and superintendents weren't sure how they would, you know, handle the issue going forward. So what happened was districts were held accountable for increasing teacher pay with whatever increase they did receive from the state during that time, even when they didn't have the promised state aid to do so.
Sure.
And then in 2017, 36 school districts didn't meet those state requirements to have, you know, their teacher compensation equal 85% of the district's increase in state funding. So they faced some penalties for that, according to our past reporting. And, you know, since then, educators have joined this nationwide call for Red for Ed, which is,
right.
you know, wearing red to raise awareness for education and lagging teacher pay and the lack of state funding and things. So I mean, it's been the trope since I was in high school that
right.
we have this teacher pay situation
yeah.
that's less than great.
Right. So what are teachers saying about this? You mentioned Red for Ed, and, you know, they're appreciative mm-hmm. of the Noem administration and this, you know, COVID-19 funding that's come. But, boy, they've had a tough year just trying to do their jobs and teach remotely. So give me a little insight into what you're hearing from teachers across the state or in the coverage area that you cover, at least.
Right. It has been a tough year for teachers. One of the things that the Sioux Falls Education Association made clear to me was, you know, this is, for lack of a better word, this is kind of a bummer that this
mm-hmm.
is the year that, you know, teacher pay isn't where they'd like it to be. A lot of teachers were severely hit by COVID. You know, some were really sick with it. Some just had a tough year not being able to see their kids and be
yeah.
back in person in some places sometimes. But also, like, the teachers I've spoken to, and I have lots of teachers in my family as well, they just go into it because they're so passionate about it. You know,
yeah.
they love working with children and educating children, and they're passionate about even the subjects that they teach. So one of the teachers I spoke to from Lenox said, you know, despite our teacher pay not being where we want it to be, it's not going to make me move to Montana or Wyoming. Like,
yeah.
she's never once thought about leaving South Dakota. So
mm-hmm.
so there's both ends of the coin there, too.
All right. We just asked education reporter Morgan Mattson to squeeze about, 2,000 words of reporting into a 5-minute radio segment. So you're just getting a highlight of that reporting. Go to argusleader.com. You might have to subscribe to see that story, but that's okay. You want to support your local newspaper too, don't you? Morgan, thanks for joining us today with a little bit of that. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori. It's a pleasure.
And we'll have more on this story in the days ahead on In the Moment and on SDPB News. Up ahead on the program, the coronavirus in India is ravaging the population now. We'll talk with an SDSU professor who used that and his family ties as inspiration to help prevent those infections. It's a pretty fascinating story around the corner on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
Hospitals serving the poorest Americans suffered during the pandemic.
Our costs went way up, and then revenue went down.
But many hospitals catering to the well-insured increased their profits.
COVID expands the financial disparity.
Why so-called safety net hospitals are struggling to stay open this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
Hi, it's Julie Rose, host of Top of Mind. Memorial Day marks the traditional beginning of summer. It's also a time to revere sacrifices made by others so that we can enjoy our freedoms. My team has put together a special hour featuring conversations about legacies and memorials. We'll learn about projects to collect soldiers' letters and to preserve veterans' memories. I hope you'll join us.
Listen Memorial Day at noon Central, 11 Mountain, and 7 Central, 6 Mountain, here on SDPB.
Take In the Moment with you wherever you go with the In the Moment podcast. New episodes drop every Friday and feature the best of the week from news and the arts. Download and subscribe to In the Moment wherever you get your podcasts. G Reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. India has set a stark new record, 4,500 deaths from COVID in a 24-hour period. The spread of infection is vicious, and many South Dakotans have family and business connections in India. Shrikant Basu is an assistant professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at South Dakota State University, and he joins us today from the Janine Basinger Studio at SDSU. We're going to talk about a potential new protocol for infection prevention that he is pioneering. Dr. Basu, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Tell me the story of your last visit, or your most recent visit, I should say, to India and what you saw there.
Yeah, so I was in India for around 5 weeks from the last week of March till beginning of May. Initially, it was sort of okay. I mean, there were some infection hotspots in the western part of the country. By the way, I was in the eastern part of the country at that time. But as we went through the month of April, it got really bad. The infection spread out to the other metro cities as well. And eventually it came to my hometown where I was in Kolkata. So I think the peak of infection was around 5th till 7th of May. Right now, if we see the profile, it's gradually slowing down. But even then, right now, I think it's around 280 to 300,000 infections, new infections each day. And the vaccination rate was picking up, but right now India has run out of new vaccines. And a number of states have enforced some level of lockdown. So the idea right now is to vaccinate as many people as they can while the lockdowns are still on, and hopefully navigate through this particular wave and see where we stand in a few months from now.
So you have family, you're in the country, you're seeing this happen and you're following it closely, but you're also in the Department of Mechanical Engineering and you're a scientist and a professor, and you're thinking deeply about how to prevent, what kind of mitigation factors can there be. Tell us a little bit of where your science interacted or intersected with a potential, I won't say solution, but, another tool in the toolbox.
Right. So, well, if I go back to my background, I was a fluid mechanician. I am a fluid mechanician. But we know that for, especially for this kind of respiratory transmissions, the flow physics is a very important component. Like we inhale the bad pathogens and then we get sick. And even when we do get sick, the infection gradually spreads through the flow physics into the lungs. So I have been active in this area for the last 6-7 years. I have been working very closely with the doctors. So when the COVID outbreak happened a year and a half back, the areas sort of aligned with the research that I was already doing. I have a number of research topics in this particular domain, but in terms of how to face the situation right now in India, we do have a number of preventives which we can put to use. One of them is nasal spray. I have been working on nasal sprays for a while now. For example, if you purchase a nasal spray bottle from the market, they typically come with some instructions on how to hold the spray bottle. And based on our research, and this is a collaboration with other universities, we have seen that if we can revise that spray usage protocol, we can send more volume of drugs to the initial infection sites for SARS-CoV-2. So that was the basic idea. We wanted to try out different orientations on how to use the spray bottle. So that was a component of work that was led by me and faculty members at Boston University and a pharmaceutical company called Fractal Therapeutics. Now, in terms of the solution that I'm proposing at this point, it's a component of research that comes from other groups. So once we know that this is the best way to use a spray bottle, we need to think about what kind of formulation you want to use in the spray bottle. And there has been a lot of work for a number of different formulations. The one that I'm proposing right now is called povidone iodine. It's more well known as betadine. There have been a number of in vitro studies where they have tried out different concentrations of betadine on SARS-CoV-2 in vitro, and that could inactivate the virus in around 15 seconds. So this is a study that came out of University of Connecticut. There was another study that came out of NUS in Singapore. They saw 99.99% virus inactivation with this particular solution.
99%? 99.99%,
almost 100%, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they exposed the virus for about 20 to 30 seconds to the solution. So there have been some in vitro studies. So there was a paper that came out in UK last year that suggested that the healthcare workers should use betadine solution, maybe as a nasal spray, maybe as a mouthwash, more as a preventive when they deal with the COVID patients. And off late, there was an in vivo clinical trial. It was a very small trial. There were 12 subjects in the control group, 12 in the intervention group, and they also saw an improvement. So the idea is this: betadine solution have been approved for human use for a while now. And we don't think there is much to lose at this point, especially in communities like in India, where we still haven't vaccinated enough people. And there are reports that other countries, for example, in Africa, there are reports that they won't be able to roll out mass vaccines until early 2024. So yes, vaccines are going to help us. Vaccines are helping us here. But we do need to think that this is a global pandemic, and we do need to explore the other preventives as well.
2024 is unacceptable.
Yeah. I mean, if there is an outbreak over there, I'm really scared what is going to happen.
Right. And the variants that can come from an uncontrolled outbreak in somewhere else in the world also impact here at home. So it is not somebody else's problem. It becomes all of our problem. I want to ask you, as you are in the middle of this science and the peer review process and how quickly, you know, the science is emerging, are there opportunities to get the kind of, you know, innovations and solutions and treatments to the world? Or is there just a delay in, you know, how these things get rolled out? Help us understand that from a non-scientific perspective.
Yeah. See, typically a good peer review process should take a few months on the scale of 5 to 6 months. And that is desired because we don't want to spread bogus science out there. So we need to be very careful about publishing correct data and make sure that we understand the science well. Now, there are another side to it. Like, for example, this nasal spray solution that I'm proposing here, it doesn't have much risk at this point. And I still want the work to go through the peer review process. But to make sure that the findings that are coming out right now are available to the public out there. So I wrote a white paper just to show how they should be using any kind of nasal spray bottle. There are people out there who are using other kinds of nasal sprays. They just need to hold the spray bottle in a different angle and to be more specific about it. Instead of holding it upright, which is what is typically prescribed, one should be holding it in a more horizontal orientation to the head, slightly angled towards the eye. So, for example, if you're holding it in the right nostril, you should angle it to the lower part of your right eye. So that can be changed very easily. And we see from our findings that just by doing that minor alteration, the targeted drug delivery for the infection sites for SARS-CoV-2 can increase by almost 100-fold in some subjects. I want to get the scientific findings out there so people can actually know how to use this kind of preventives. But at the end of the day, peer review is a very important component of the work that we do.
Yeah. How is your family?
They're overall well. My parents, so my father is 66 years old now, and my mother is 58. Both received both the doses of vaccine. So I'm slightly worry-free about them. I mean, they can still get infected, but with the vaccine effect, the infection is probably not going to make them too sick. My aunt and my uncle, they're like in their late 40s and late 50s. They did get infected even after getting the second dose, but they did not really got too sick, so we did not have to hospitalize them. I'm really worried about my grandmother, who is 82 years old. We could not vaccinate her because the hospitals are too crowded. So just to take her over there for the vaccination just creates so many other risks.
Shukat Basu, Assistant Professor in Department of Mechanical Engineering at South Dakota State University. Dr. Basu, thank you so much for this and for being part of that global science effort to save lives during this pandemic. We appreciate your time here today.
Thank you.
Dr. Basu joined us from the Janine Basinger Studio on the campus of South Dakota State University. Ahead on the program, we talk mental health with Serene Thin Elk. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
The CDC has loosened its COVID guidelines for people who are vaccinated. But in India, the pandemic is rampaging across the country. On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter Jeffrey Gettleman joins us from New Delhi, where he says sickness and death are everywhere. He's reported from war zones, was kidnapped in Iraq, but finds this frightening in a different way. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by Sanford Underground Research Facility. Advancing South Dakota's economy. Creating jobs that support world-leading science, education, and our communities. More about America's Underground Research Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
Song of the Soldier for a Day of Remembrance. I'm Scott Simon. Please join me here for Alan Seeger, Instrument of Destiny.
Listen Memorial Day evening at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCroryGardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Millions of Americans live with mental illness, and overcoming the stigma in order to seek qualified help can be one of the greatest barriers to effective treatment. Well, that treatment has advanced significantly in recent years, even as some solutions tap into age-old truths and traditional ways of community. Serene Thin Elk is a behavioral health therapist and director of behavioral health at South Dakota Urban Indian Health. She's also the co-founder of Generation Red Road, and she joins us today as part of Mental Health Awareness Month coverage on SDPB. Serene Thin Elk, thanks for being here. We appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of the conversation.
This is something that you have been deeply involved in for some time. Tell me how you came to this line of work in behavioral health. What drew you toward this profession?
Well, I think I, from a young age, have always been very amazed by just the human spirit and how our mental health and our emotional well-being is such an important part of our daily living. And so I had the opportunity to be around some pretty amazing elders and people growing up that reminded me about holistic wellness. And it just felt natural to go into this line of work and now to be a provider, but also an advocate to help people get the help that they need in this area.
Did you have, when you went through training, you know, based on what you had learned from elders and traditional ways, and then you go through, you know, sort of the most modern behavioral health, you know, education, were there conflicts, synergies? Where do those things intersect for you as the behavioral health specialist?
So there definitely were differences, and at times it felt very conflictual. I think the more that I have done growing personally, culturally, and also in my profession, I'm able to see that it's actually quite easy to integrate all of those different teachings, ways of life, and some of the clinical interventions. I think the hard part can be at times finding within the workplace the support to be able to integrate those things if they aren't, you know, evidence-based or empirically supported. And so at times that has been a challenge, but I really have seen a shift with people in various different spheres of our community, all the way from judges to other therapists to medical providers, teachers, who are saying, you know, what we have been doing with our Native relatives, with our Native community, has not been working. And we have the numbers to prove that the interventions that we're currently using have not been successful. And so they're starting to reach out more to people in the community to say, can you help us to integrate your culture and your life ways into the things that we're already doing?
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about just overcoming some of those barriers to talking about some of these issues, whether it's, you know, OCD or addiction or, you know, a stress-related, just, you know, low-key stress management kind of things. Mm-hmm. What are some of the obstacles to just seeking treatment, admitting that there's a problem that you need help for and that you can't really handle on your own? It has to be handled in community or with professionals.
Yeah, so I think that there's a lot of layers to this. And one is the more education that we can get out, even, you know, during schooling for our children in the health classes, to talk about mental health the same way that we talk about physical well-being and asking for medical care. The more education and normalizing that we can get out into the community and society will help people to first recognize the signs and symptoms of mental health so that they can look at themselves and say, yeah, you know, I have been sleeping more, or I have been isolating more. I haven't been wanting to reach out for help. So the very nature of mental health issues when they feel heavy and overwhelming is you have a tendency to want to isolate, and shame can also accompany that. So that very often keeps people in this place of trying to do it on their own. And then eventually, without reaching out at all, without any intervention or talking to people, it can turn into things that get even heavier and can lead to addiction. It can lead to suicidality. It can lead to a lot of different things that they're really trying to cope, but aren't doing it in a way that's really effective and healthy for them. Mm. So education comes first out in the community. And then it's also, I think, being able to destigmatize within yourself these barriers and things that maybe through societal conditioning, you believe that it's weak to ask for help. Mm. It is absolutely not weak. It actually takes a lot of strength to be vulnerable and say, I'm human and I'm struggling in these areas. And it very often starts with going to your doctor, you know, and so I think that's why it's so important for people to complete certain screenings like the PHQ-9 for depression or the GAD-7 for anxiety, so that the professional, the doctor, can then say, wow, I see you're really struggling. Let me give you a referral, and kind of helping them to seek that help. So yeah. There's a lot of different ways to approach it in order to get help.
I don't think I've ever said this on the radio, but this seems like a very good time. But 20 years ago, when I had my daughter, I suffered from postpartum depression. And one of the obstacles for me was I was so afraid if I told somebody that they would take away my child. And of course, that would have been the biggest nightmare for me as a mother. So I struggled with, well, what are the consequences of admitting this? Do you see, I know I eventually got help because I was in a relationship with my midwife at the time, and she was able to walk me through that because she was asking me questions that that I felt safe answering. But do you see that with people, whether it's through addiction treatment or depression treatment, especially parents and mothers I'm thinking of right now, that fear of or actually losing your child and trying to get them back can be just such a huge thing to come alongside?
Yes, yes, that is a really good point. And it brings me back to certain points in my life where I actually really needed mental health support. And I also was very afraid because at the time I was early on in the mental health professional field. And I thought to myself, this is terrible. Like they're going to put me in a very behavioral health. And some of my colleagues are there, you know, I mean, that fear can definitely take over, which is a reality. And I think this is a part of education. And this is a part of doing interviews and discussions like this on the radio, is being able to say, please don't be afraid. Please seek help. And we are genuinely here to help, and no one is there to take away your rights in any form. It really is. It's a confidential space. And the only time that we have to go outside of that confidential space is when we're genuinely worried about, you know, suicide or severe abuse and neglect, those sorts of things. But outside of that, there's really nothing that I have been told that I haven't been able to say, I'm here for you and let's get you the resources and the help that you need. So I think a part of taking away some of that fear and inviting people to step into that unknown is knowing that mental health care really is set up to support you in your journey.
Yeah. I would say two more things, and that's, you know, when I only have one child, but talking with that same midwife about future pregnancies, she said, well, we're going to do things a little different this time. And I was so resistant to that, Serena. I was like, why, you know, why would we do something before I'm even depressed? Like, I don't agree with this. And what, you know, who do you think I am? And she looked at me and held my hand and said, it doesn't have to be this hard. And so when I think of other people who are in that space, I just want to say it doesn't have to be this hard. And if you get help from the right people, there is a light on the other side, and there was for me. And it's worth the work that you do to overcome some of those things, because honestly, they're really hard. They're hard things to go through, aren't they?
They are. Thank you for sharing that, Lori. Yeah. It's very, I like how you said there's a light at the end of the tunnel, because there is. And that's when we're struggling within our hearts and minds with whatever is heavy in our thoughts and heavy in our hearts. It's really easy to assume the worst and catastrophize and feel very alone. And when in fact it does take courage to step forward. And when you do, you're like, man, I was really holding myself kind of emotionally hostage there. Like I wasn't allowing myself to get the help and receive the grace from others that I really needed to start getting better on my journey.
Yeah. It takes up so much energy too. You'll be surprised how much energy you have when once you get through some of those things, you're like, wow, that's why I couldn't get anything done. But I want to ask about this, you know, pandemic year that we've had, and we talk about isolation and loneliness and depression and addiction. We were all kind of set up environmentally to struggle through some very tough times, the anxiety of, you know, washing your hands and getting ill, grief and loss. Are there things that you would say, especially for people who are listening from Indigenous or tribal communities, where you can say, look, this is how we come together during and after a really difficult collective experience like this?
Yeah, so if there's one thing that we know about our ancestors, it's the intergenerational resilience. And very often now, as we're bringing awareness and again trying to destigmatize mental health for our Native relatives and Indigenous people in general, is to say that, you know, the historical trauma definitely has an impact in it. It's ever present today. And so as we talk about those negative things, I think it's equally important to talk about the resiliency and the things that our ancestors did with fortitude to get through really, honestly, all of the attempts to eradicate who we are as people. And so through the generations, we are still here. And yes, there are effects of that trauma and systemic oppression that are present. And we also have to tune back into the strength because it has never left. That strength has never left. We just have to be more creative and in tune with ourselves in order to access that strength that is ever present. And so there's a lot of ways that people have tried to do kind of more of that prayer, ceremony, meditation on their own, having to develop more practices, recognizing their own strength, and honestly, telehealth. That's a big one. As we're looking at practical solutions to addressing it, there's a lot of options for people who are maybe at home or can't find a babysitter or whatever it may be, to say that, please, let's normalize mental health needs and let's get those resources there for people to access them.
Yeah. I love the idea of just thinking back, whatever your family, you know, I'm thinking back now as you say that to the other women in my family who had children throughout the generations from wherever their country of origin was, and just really thinking of all the different ways that they must have struggled as well. You know, if you're queer in this community and you're feeling, you know, oppressed or stressed, you know, think of all the people who, you know, who came before and couldn't even speak out about some of those things. And then, of course, as you say, that systemic oppression and that boarding school trauma and that sexual assault trauma and all these things, there's a lot to be just in touch with about what people have gone through and have survived. It's really kind of stunning and a little overwhelming in some ways as well. Let's leave people with a few thoughts about some of those things you can do today. We've talked about having a relationship with the physician and talking to somebody. You know, I want to add to listeners, if you are feeling suicidal or you know someone who has suicidal ideations, you can call the 800 number, 800-273-8255. We always try to make sure we bring that up in conversations that are difficult like this one. Are there other things that you think, Serene Thin Elk, that people can say, I need a little relief today and this is where I'm going to begin?
So I think that the first step is just listening to yourself. And if you really tune in and listen, knowing that you need help. And I think a lot of people know it, but they really then say, I can't ask for help. So just taking that first step to call, start asking around, asking friends, do you know of a good therapist? Do you know of any support groups? Do you know, maybe it's at their church, maybe it's coming to ceremony, to a NEPI, to SWEAT. Taking those very first steps to connection and community can help slowly kind of break some of the isolation that all of us have really felt during the pandemic. And let's be honest, even pre-pandemic, a lot of feelings of isolation. So being able to counter that with connection and community, and a lot of things organically happen from there in terms of healing. Healing is this really powerful thing that kind of unfolds for each of us when we take a leap into the unknown. And really setting up those appointments, I think. I talk to a lot of people who call here and say, I'm scared, or I actually think I want to cancel my appointment. I don't want to come in. And I just kind of talk through that with them and let them know it's okay. It's okay. Yeah. And this is going to be a good thing for you to take care of yourself.
Serene Thin Elk, thank you for sitting in this space with us today and welcoming so many people in our listening area to that conversation. We really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Serene Thin Elk is a behavioral health therapist. She leads the efforts at South Dakota Urban Indian Health, and she's also co-founder of Generation Red Road. She joined us today for Mental Health Awareness Month in the month of May. Let's take a moment now with Gloria Hansen. So first, to do that, we need to head to Fort Pier, nestled in the bluffs of the vast Missouri River. The terrain is rugged and beautiful and seemingly endless. It is the oldest continuously occupied white settlement in South Dakota. The people there are resilient and they're connected to that history. They know a public election might still be decided by a high card draw. Well, Gloria Hansen is mayor of Fort Pierre, and 10 years ago, Pierre and Fort Pierre braced themselves for severe flooding that ravaged the length of the Missouri River. Mayor Hansen spoke to SDPB's Larry Rohr about how the community is planning to deal with high water in the future, even as they celebrate the spirit and hardiness and heritage of an Old West past.
One thing that has changed is that the Corps of Engineers has greatly improved their communication with communities who are on this river system, and that helps. And so you have a greater level of confidence that they're paying attention. But we all pay more attention. We can almost, any of us can tell you what the snowpack situation is in Montana, and is it likely going to come down fast and hard like it did in 2011? But we are working on a long-term plan that will provide an opportunity for us to better protect ourselves. And one of the things that we need to do is to figure out how to shut off the storm sewer system, because it becomes an intake. But you can't shut that off too soon, or you're going to have problems also. And in 2011, it wasn't just the water in the river that created a problem. It was groundwater. I was on a radio interview, and we were talking about the election. I was remembering an election 30 or 40 years ago for state's attorney. Bernie Duffy and Chuck Poches ended up in a tie. And in true Fort Pierre fashion, after they had counted and recounted, and they always ended up in a tie, they did a high card draw to see who got the office. And before that, there was a mayor's race that was decided by a flip of a coin because it was a tie. That's just Fort Pierre. And I love the spirit and, that West River hardiness of this town. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon.
And says Fort Pierre is the only town in South Dakota that has celebrated a bicentennial, established in 1817. But it's also a progressive community with river access to new residential and business development. You can learn more about the community in the May broadcast of Dakota Life on SDPB-TV. Ahead on the program, herbs and vegetables sprout side by side to create a South Dakota garden. Eric Helland is with us. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. The current crisis in the Middle East is part of a long history between Israel and the Palestinians and decades of U.S. attempts to broker peace in the region. We'll get a history lesson from advisor to the State Department and expert on the region, Aaron David Miller. That's next time, here and now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
Trumpeter Charlie Sepulveda says many kinds of music are put in the category of Latin jazz, but he believes they don't belong unless the music has that Afro-Cuban beat. The title of Sepulveda's latest album announces his point of view. This is Latin jazz. He says the album is a tribute to Tito Puente, Pancho Sanchez, Cal Jader, and other masters of Latin jazz. I'm Carl Gerke, and we'll hear tracks from Sepulveda's new album this evening on Jazz Nightly. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Underwriting SDPB Radio enhances your corporate image and projects quality and credibility. Stand out from the competition and reach a quality audience. Include SDPB Radio in your branding campaign. SDPB.org/support.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's turn our attention now to the soil and seeds that help our gardens grow. Eric Helland is president and CEO of Landscape Garden Centers in Sioux Falls, and he's joining us for this week's South Dakota Home and Garden. You can send Eric questions throughout the week via email in the moment at sdpb.org. We'll gather those up and ask Eric your questions all summer through September, I think, on South Dakota Home and Garden. Today we talk vegetables and herbs. Eric, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. How are you?
I am doing well. All right. These things can go in our garden side by side. Tell me a little bit about this episode of Home and Garden.
Gardening right now, or I guess what we've been talking about is just, you know, we picked out a spot, what places where we could have gardens, and now what we've been doing is talking about the plants and the kind of the choosing of the plants. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's kind of where it gets to be somewhat up to everybody's taste, figuring out if you have full sun, well-drained soil, and then just picking out the right plant for the right space.
Sure. All right. So seeds or plants, first of all, when I think about vegetables and, basil or mint or something, I think, am I planting a little starter plant or am I planting a seed in the ground?
Sure. So when you get seeds, you're just going to see the whole life cycle of a seed. So some of those are going to take a little bit longer to germinate, meaning basically they go from a seed to a one leaf and start to develop their root system. With buying a plant, let's just pick on the cucumber for now. A cucumber, if you buy the plant, you know, you're going to probably get, you know, 2 to 3 weeks advance. The plant will be a little bit bigger. It costs a little bit more, but you're a little bit further along. The plant, you'll be able to see how healthy it is, whereas the seed, you're going to have to wait for it to develop. So in choosing what type of plants to use, seeds for cucumbers, that works great. Herbs, I typically would say it's the best thing to do with those is to buy them as a plant, because then you're going to be able to see them. They're going to start, they grow right away. And with herbs, you're using foliage. Is basically that's what you're cutting off basil leaves, for example, sure, or using the oregano or things like that. Those you'll be able to use in a much sooner than as if you're going to plant a seed or even a cucumber plant, because those are going to take a lot longer to develop and produce their fruits.
Yeah. So when can you start pinching off some of those herbs to use? And to still have the, you know, to maintain the foliage and have it continue to, you know, meet your needs for a while. Any tricks there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So once you get the herb plant into the ground and it's become established, you're going to start to notice the growth difference between when you first planted it and when, the time period that you've waited. So maybe it's been 2 to 3 weeks. Mm. Then you can just start taking the very tips of those herbs, and when you trim those tips, those are going to have the most fragrant, the best tasting. And then right wherever you've trimmed, those are going to sprout new growth, and you'll be able to kind of come up with for the different herbs the different basically cycle of trimming them off. And yeah, sometimes you're going to be able to trim off a little bit more based on, it'd be nice if we get some good heat, because once we get some heat and good sun, which we haven't seen for a while, things are really going to start to pop. And then that's when you're going to be able to start taking, at least once a week, some of those herbs, trimming those herbs and using them within your cooking.
Yeah. All right. You got to fight back the weeds. Let's. How important is it to get to those weeds? And what if you don't? What if you're a little behind on your weed management in your garden? What happens? What happens to the good stuff when the bad stuff goes awry?
Yeah. So weeds are, and this is why we call them weeds, is because they grow extremely aggressively. They will be growing. They really don't care if it's hot or cold. They just grow, it seems to be. It's just no matter what, they have their own agenda and they keep it. And their agenda is to survive and produce more seeds and flowers and stuff like that. So as soon as you start to see weeds, you really want to start pulling them out. The smaller they are, the better. weeds will take a lot of the nutrients away from the plants, the beneficial plants. So if your garden gets to be a little bit overwhelmed, you'll be surprised is that weeds will even choke out other weeds. But you'll notice that some of the larger weeds will overtake, and you might not take too much to actually gain control. Mm. The broadleaf weeds are the easiest ones to control. Grass is really tough to control when it gets into a garden because grass has got all of its roots below, and it'll send out a lot of different shoots all over. And just the tall grasses, even bluegrass, can be a real bugger once it gets into a landscape bed or a garden.
Their agenda is to survive. I'm writing that down. Isn't that the truth? I can relate. Some days the agenda is just to survive. Eric Helland, thank you so much for being here with us today. Keep it growing.
Yep, thanks, Lori.
So we'll talk about a few ways you can be part of SDPB's gardening and growing community now. You can tune in on Thursdays like today to hear Eric Helland answer your questions. Just send us an email inthemoment@sdpb.org. Anytime throughout the week, we'll get your question in queue. You can also join other South Dakota gardeners on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by using the hashtag SDHomeGarden. And new segments of the digital series are posted every week at sdpb.org/SD Home Garden. Those segments are also broadcast on SDPB TV through September 12th. Kelvin Torve grew up in Rapid City playing for legendary post-22 coach Dave Plouffe. He would eventually see Major League Baseball experience with the Minnesota Twins and New York Mets before signing with Japan's Oryx Blue Wave. Now Torve is back in Rapid City coaching the team for which he once played post-22. And he is the subject of a new In Play with Craig Maddock podcast. You can find that wherever you find your podcast and head to sdpb.org to learn more. Craig Maddock is here with us with some highlights from that conversation. Hey, Craig, welcome back.
Lori, it's always great to talk with you. Hope things are well, and appreciate you with the promoting the podcast. It's been fun doing the podcast. And what intrigued me with Kelvin Torve, what intrigues me is stories of people who coached their alma mater.
Yeah.
The stories of how they got there. Because I think for the most part, when we were graduating from our high school, we had no idea, or we had no plans of whatsoever to be coaching where we played. But, you know, maybe that's changing a little bit more because,
yeah.
I mean, look at the state B boys basketball tournament last year. 5 of the 8 coaches were coaching their alma mater.
Yeah.
And with Kelvin Torve, I mean, grew up in Rapid, played for post-22, went to Oral Roberts, and played for the Twins. And, in fact, one thing from the podcast, it was the year after the Twins won the World Series, and Kelvin talked about what that experience was like.
Well, you said year after win the World Series. I guess my timing is 1 year off because I got to ORU the year after they went to the World Series, and I got to the Twins the year after they went to the World Series. So, you know, professional baseball is a meat grinder. It's really difficult. You know, I got drafted by the Giants and made it to AAA with them. And then I got traded to the Orioles, made it to AAA with them. And to be honest, Craig, I didn't know if I was ever going to make it. Hmm. And if I was a betting man, I would have bet no because I was 27 years old and had no big league experience. But I signed with the Twins and got off to a good start in Portland, which was a AAA team. And Tommy Herr went down. He was a second baseman, but yet the Twins needed a left-handed pinch hitter off the bench. So I got the call up and, you know, I was only there a month, but my gosh, it was just fantastic. I had a great time, and, you know, I got a couple hits to help him win games, which was great, you know, gratifying.
One home run.
But it was, you know, just a culmination of a lot of hard work and just being in the right place at the right time.
Hmm. I was going to say, Craig Maddock, when you said when we were graduating, we weren't thinking about returning home to coach her, but when I was graduating, those Twins were winning the World Series. So this is a familiar.
Maybe the last time they won a playoff game. It's been 17 years.
Yeah. All right. So,
but he kept at it.
You know, let's Kelvin get to this next. I want to get to this next part of him coming home because I'm really curious about that. In the interest of time, set this clip up for us, please.
He got out of baseball, but then had an opportunity to come back to Rapid City, but he had one condition: he would come back to Rapid in post 22.
Right. Well, when they Mitch Messer was the head coach when and he started calling me, and Tom Ruderbusch was involved as well, about moving back and coaching. And the year before I moved back, we tried, but it just didn't work out because I was working at the classical school, which I just really enjoyed. But then the circumstances had changed with the school, and an opportunity presented itself to come back to Rapid and coach. And I told Mitch and Rudy, I said that, you know, I'll come back under the only condition I have is that I would never be the varsity head coach. I said, I don't want the job. You know, I'll be the assistant coach at the lowest level or anywhere in between, but I won't be the head coach because I didn't want it. I didn't think I was qualified. And then, you know, after 2 years of coaching the lowest level team, our program had some transition going on. And I realized that, you know, if I didn't take it, you know, our program would be in a bad way. And I started thinking about it and I got my head around it and I said, yeah, I think I can do this. And so I agreed to take the head coaching job, and I have absolutely loved every minute of it ever since.
A little bit from Craig Maddock's podcast, In Play with Craig Maddock, the voice you heard, Kelvin Torvay, who is now coaching post 22. What kind of person is he, Craig? As you sit down, we know a little bit about his journey, but spending time with him, how would you describe him?
I like Kelvin a lot. I think he is a guy who loves baseball and wants to teach the game.
Yeah.
And wants his players to enjoy the game. I'd play for Kelvin. He was so much fun to talk to, and I hope people understand a little bit more about Kelvin and what he's been through and what he wants to do for high school kids in post 22 in Rapid City. Just a fun guy to talk to. I hope people get a chance to hear the podcast.
And what a successful program that is. So, all right, you can hear the podcast. Go to iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and look for In Play with Craig Maddock. You can also find more at our website at sdpb.org. And, of course, you can always amplify that with a review and comments on it. Communicate with Craig that way as well. Craig, thanks for being here. We appreciate your time.
Lori, as always, it's great talking with you. We'll talk again soon.
Yes, sir. And if you love sports in South Dakota, you should follow the SDPB Sports Facebook page and Twitter feed as well. Those sports reporters are out across the state bringing you the latest and often play-by-play. It's good stuff. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to dive into the housing market. Have you been hearing from people who want to buy your home? Have you tried to buy a home and not been able to to get one because somebody outbid you? How about writing love letters to the owners of the home to see if you can convince them to accept your offer? We're going to talk about that tomorrow. If you have a story to share, email me inthemoment@sdpb.org. We'll talk about home ownership in the state. For Crystal Schoenbauer, Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.